Okay, sorry about that. Let's begin by reading our text from Exodus chapter 5 tonight. We're not going to read the entire fifth chapter as we backed up and did last week. I would like to pick up, however, in verse 15. We'll talk after the reading about some matters of interest with regard to review and setting the stage for our study tonight. So we'll start in verse 15. We're going to pay particular attention to verses 20 and 21 of Exodus chapter 5. The word of God says, "Then the foreman of the sons of Israel came and cried out to Pharaoh, saying, 'Why do you deal this way with your servants? There is no straw given to your servants, yet they keep saying to us, "Make bricks." And behold, your servants are being beaten, but it is the fault of your own people.' But he said, 'You are lazy, very lazy. Therefore you say, "Let us go and sacrifice to the Lord." So go now and work, for you shall be given no straw, yet you must deliver the quota of bricks.' And the foreman of the sons of Israel saw that they were in trouble, because they were told, 'You must not reduce your daily amount of bricks.'" Now, in verse 20 and 21 contains the text for our lesson tonight. The record says, "When they left Pharaoh's presence, they met Moses and Aaron as they were waiting for them. And they said to them, 'May the Lord look upon you and judge you, for you have made us odious in Pharaoh's sight and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us.'" Now, throughout this study, and this is the 14th lesson, we had one which was an introductory lesson, so this is our 15th time together. And throughout all of these efforts, we've tried to emphasize that what we're talking about is spiritual leadership. Leadership in the home, leadership in our peer groups, at work, leadership certainly in our local fellowships of our congregations. So throughout all of this, we've been looking through the life of Moses from early on and picking out points that will help us to not only understand leadership, but in some cases to help us understand ourselves so that we may respond to leadership better. So we're kind of looking at both sides of this, both as sheep and as shepherds. Now, certainly some of the things that we've talked about and some of the things that we'll talk about tonight would apply to shepherds in the local congregation in an official capacity. But more importantly, I'm hoping that we learn to be leaders in our own small sphere of influence, whatever they may be, or perhaps however great that sphere of influence may be. That we can be leaders for the cause of Christ, for God, and help to bring others to Christ or back to Christ, and do a better job of it through our efforts in this particular study. Now, what I'd like us to do to begin then for tonight is to have a quick review of some pertinent points leading up to this particular junction in our study. We're not going to review everything, but just some pertinent points to get us to where we need to be tonight. Moses has been sent to Egypt with his brother Aaron to help him to deliver them from Egyptian bondage. They've been there for some 400 plus years by this point. You can go back and read Exodus chapter 4, verses 12 through 17, and it will tell you about Moses' initial conversation with God and how he was being sent to Egypt. When they got there, they relayed all the words of the Lord to the elders or to the leaders of the people of Israel. And again, chapter 4, verses 29 and 30 convey that part of the story. At that point, and I do want to look back and note verse 31 because we're going to draw upon it in just a few moments. In verse 31, the text says of chapter 4 in Exodus, "So the people believed." Now, after Moses and Aaron have gotten there and they've relayed to the people, to the leaders and to the people of the sons of Israel, all that God has said about these things, how that they are to be delivered from Egyptian bondage, how they are to be led to the promised land of Canaan, this land that flows with milk and honey. So in verse 31 of Exodus 4, the text says, "So the people believed, And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about the sons of Israel, and that he had seen their affliction, then they bowed low and worshiped. I want us to note that in particular, that when Moses and Aaron presented the plan, if you will, full disclosure, told them what was going to happen, when they presented the plan to deliver Israel from Egyptian bondage, the people believed and bowed low and worshiped God. Now, as we go forward then into chapter 5, Moses and Aaron have entered into Egypt and they've gone to see Pharaoh. They tell him of this request that the Lord has instructed them to make, to let Israel go into the wilderness that they might sacrifice to the Lord their God 3 days' journey, so that God would not be displeased with him, as verse 3 says in chapter 5, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword. And then from verses 4 down through verses 14 of chapter 5, Pharaoh flatly refuses and imposes even greater hardships upon the people. They're going to have to keep up with the same building program. They're going to have to keep up with the same quota of bricks in this production process of building without the Egyptians furnishing them with straw. They're going to have to go throughout the land of Egypt and gather their own straw to keep up with these quotas. In chapter 5, verses 15 and 16, the foremen of the sons of Israel go and bring protest, actually, to Pharaoh. Verse 15 says, they cried out to Pharaoh. And they presented their case. They pled their case to Pharaoh, how unfairly they were being treated. Well, we talked about it previously. That was the wrong man to go to. Pharaoh obviously was the man who had made the order in the first place, and furthermore, he didn't believe in God in the first place, from verse 2 of our text here in chapter 5. So Pharaoh again refuses and reiterates these new and further oppressive requirements in verses 17 and 18. Finally, we saw last week from verse 19 that after the foremen of the sons of Israel have gone to Pharaoh and pled their case, and he's flatly refused and reiterated these new requirements, they realize that they're in trouble. So that brings us to verse 20. When they left Pharaoh's presence, they met Moses and Aaron. Probably where they should have gone to in the first place. Skip Pharaoh altogether. He's not there to deliver them from Egyptian bondage. He's responsible for it. Moses and Aaron are there as God's emissaries to deliver them from Egyptian bondage. So they probably went to the wrong source and should certainly have gone to Moses and Aaron in the first place. But there are some things here within verses 20 and 21, and yes, I know that's only two verses. You've been studying with me for the last 15 lessons. You know that's plenty. Excuse me. All that yard work today is getting to me. There are some things here that I think we should pay particular attention to for just a few moments this evening. First of all, notice from verse 20 that when the foremen of the sons of Israel get done with Pharaoh and they go to find Moses and Aaron, they find Moses and Aaron waiting for them. At first, when I was studying for this, I kind of read over that and didn't really stop and think about it. But then I began to realize that the Holy Spirit doesn't put things in the text that aren't there for a reason. So why was this part that Moses and Aaron were waiting for them, why was it included in the text? Well, consider a couple of related pieces of data with me for just a moment, and perhaps we can come to some understanding and at least allow me the opportunity to make the point why I think it's important. Moses and Aaron, first of all, knew that the initial request to let the people go was not going to work. If you go back to Exodus chapter 3 and in verse 19, God told Moses this from the outset. In Exodus 3:19, God says, "But I know that the king of Egypt will not permit you to go except under compulsion." Look also at the fourth chapter and verse 28. And Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord which he had sent him, and all the signs that he had commanded him to do. The point from verse 28 is, yes, God has told Moses that this is not going to work, and Moses has told Aaron. Pharaoh's not going to let these people go except under compulsion. God said, go ask him anyway. There was a process that had to be gone through here to give Pharaoh the opportunity. As we discussed previously, God foreknowing what would happen does not mean that God caused it to happen. He's simply predicting to Moses, and then certainly to Aaron, as Moses communicated these things to him, that Pharaoh is not going to listen. I'm going to have to compulse him to let my people go. So number one, Moses and Aaron knew that Pharaoh was not going to let the people of Israel go without this compulsion, whatever they understood that that meant at this time. Secondly, they also knew that crying out to Pharaoh wouldn't work since he didn't believe in the authority of God. Here in chapter 5 and in verse 2, Pharaoh responds to this initial request by saying, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and besides, I will not let Israel go." So now Pharaoh has confirmed exactly what God had predicted. Had to go through the process, had to make the offer, give Pharaoh the opportunity to do the right thing. But now, again, consider this from Moses and Aaron's perspective. God said he's not going to let them go without compulsion. Pharaoh confirms that by saying, "I don't believe the Lord. I don't respect the authority of God. And furthermore, I'm not going to let this people go." So that leads us to number three. When the foreman of the sons of Israel went to Pharaoh to plead their case, Moses and Aaron knew that it was Pharaoh who had instigated these new reforms in the first place. It wasn't the taskmasters of the Egyptians that dreamed this harsh treatment and oppressive behavior, this brutality up on their own in their treatment of the sons of Israel. That came from the top down, from Pharaoh down to these taskmasters. So Moses and Aaron thirdly knew that going to Pharaoh wasn't going to work. What does that have to do with Moses and Aaron waiting? Well, think this through with me for just a moment. Good leaders know that efforts to avoid the consequences of doing the right thing are going to fail. We'll get to Luke, the 15th chapter, in just a moment. Moses and Aaron knew this wasn't going to work. But the foreman of the sons of Israel wanted to go and plead their case to Pharaoh. They're hoping to avoid the consequences of this harsh treatment, this harsh behavior, and to be able to go and to sacrifice to God in the wilderness. There's going to be a cost associated with their freedom, with their belief in God that they manifested back in the fourth chapter in verse 31, and their commitment to God, which they are now renewing at the urging of Moses and Aaron. Moses and Aaron knew these things. So apparently, at least the record doesn't record any such thing, there was no effort put forth by Moses and Aaron to the sons of Israel saying, "Don't go do that. Don't go talk to Pharaoh. He's the one that initiated these harsh treatments. He doesn't believe in God. And furthermore, God said he's not going to let you go unless God makes him let you go." They didn't do that. Because sometimes good leaders know you can't avoid the consequences of doing the right thing. Israel has believed in God. They've dedicated themselves at this point, at least, to Moses and Aaron as God's appointed leaders, and they apparently think all they have to do is to go to Pharaoh and say, "No, wait a minute. I know you told Moses and Aaron no, but you don't understand." Yes, Pharaoh did understand. It was they who didn't understand. There were going to be cost factors that were necessary for them to attain their freedom. Perhaps even God is preparing them some through these plagues for the difficulties of the journey ahead. Keeping in mind, and of course I recognize as do you, that most of these plagues did not affect the sons of Israel, only the Egyptians. But here's my point. Back from Luke 15. And again, I reiterate from the middle of point number one there. Good leaders often know that efforts to avoid the consequences of doing the right thing are going to fail. In Luke, the 15th chapter, there is the parable of two brothers, the prodigal and the older. I think actually the older brother is the more significant emphasis to be made to Jesus' audience at the time. But think about this with me for just a moment. When the man that had two sons had his younger son come to him and say, "Father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me," he probably knew what the younger son was going to do with it. If this younger son was ready for that kind of responsibility, surely his father would have given it to him already. By rights, it was not to be the son's inheritance until the father died. This younger son would have gotten 1/3, the older brother would have gotten 2/3 of the family inheritance. But this younger brother comes and says to his father, "Give me my portion." Now, all I'm wanting you to think about with me is that the father, if there is a representation at all in this, it is the father would represent our father, the father, surely knew what was going to happen. But he gave the younger son the money anyway. Why? Because it was pointless to reason with him. There were some lessons this younger son was going to have to learn for himself. Namely, that Galatians chapter 6 and verses 7 and 8 says that when we sow to the flesh, we shall from the flesh reap corruption. Undoubtedly, this father has tried to teach this younger son and his older brother the right things to do. The right thing to do was for this younger brother to be patient and to wait for his share of the inheritance. But he's trying to circumvent that. The father gave him the money. I'm convinced, knowing, yes, I realize this is a made-up story, but I'm convinced nonetheless that in this scenario that Jesus lays out, the father knew full well what the younger son was going to do. He was going to waste this inheritance. He was going to fall flat on his face and have to come home begging to be readmitted to the family. So what did the father do? He gave him the money and then he waited longingly. He saw the prodigal coming back from afar off. The only way you see things from afar off is to be looking for them, to be waiting for them, to be anticipating them. So what I'm suggesting to you here is that Moses and Aaron knew this effort to go talk to Pharaoh and plead and try to reason with him was going to fail. Did they try to stop it? No. The foreman of the sons of Israel, we're going to have to learn this lesson the hard way. They also were going to have to suffer these hardships that Pharaoh has enacted before they were eventually freed from their bondage. The price of freedom is not, has never been free. These Israelites were going to have to pay for this freedom. There was going to be a toll exacted, not by God, by the Egyptians, before they were allowed to go. So Moses and Aaron simply waited for them to return, knowing that their efforts were going to fail. I see in my mind's eye Moses and Aaron just sitting outside the palace, patting their feet and waiting. They knew these foremen are coming back. They knew it was not going to work. And they're waiting patiently to pick up the pieces and try to move forward, to try to do some coaching and coach up these foremen and help them to understand not only why what just happened, but what to do about it, how to feel about it, all those kind of things. That's exactly what the prodigal son's father did in Luke the 15th chapter in verse 17 through 24, when that prodigal son was beaten down and had to come back home, admitting his mistakes. Good leaders know that sometimes you just have to let people fail. It's hard. When you know that what they're about to attempt is not the right thing to do, and because of that, it's going to fail. It's hard to sit back and wait and watch people make mistakes that will ultimately, in many cases, make their life and their plight even harder. But sometimes, we just are hard-headed enough that we have to make our own mistakes. Moses and Aaron, they just waited. They waited for these foremen to return so they could try again to help them. So, good leaders know that sometimes you just have to let people fail. And what you do is you wait for them to return and they try to help them move forward. Number two in our outline. In the first part of verse 21, when these foremen of the sons of Israel come back to Moses and Aaron, who have been apparently waiting patiently, they cursed Moses and Aaron. The text of verse 21 says, they said to them, may the Lord look upon you and judge you, for you have made us odious in Pharaoh's sight, in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in his hand to kill us. What are they saying? Moses and Aaron, this is your fault. You got us into this mess. We were better off before you ever showed up, promising us freedom, promising us deliverance. Yeah, we were slaves, but we had it pretty good. We had all of our meals. They brought us straw. We made bricks. We built cities for them. But all in all, it wasn't too bad here in bondage. This is your fault, Moses and Aaron, and may the Lord judge you. That's a cursing. This is the first time that Israel would rebel against Moses and Aaron and reject those whom God had sent to help them. It was the first time, but it would not be the last. In the book of Numbers, in the 11th chapter in verse 1, we see a prime example of many others that could be cited, when it says, now the people became like those who complain of adversity in the hearing of the Lord. And when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. In the 14th chapter of Numbers, in verses 1 through 3, again, the congregation lifted up their voices and cried and wept all that night. Verse 2, the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The whole congregation of them said, would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or that we had died in this wilderness. And why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not have been better for us to return to Egypt? So what we're seeing here in Exodus chapter 4, in verse 21, is the first rebellion, the first rejection, the first complaints about Moses and Aaron, and certainly the first time they've called upon the Lord to curse them and to have the Lord judge them. Now, think about it. Again, think about it. Jesus came to the earth to enlighten and to save mankind from the bonds of sin, from captivity to Satan, to servitude to sin and Satan, to a life that was from a life that was doomed. He came to enlighten and save mankind, but those who were his own did not receive him. Go back and read John the first chapter, verses 9 through 11. John the third chapter, verses 16 through 19. Remember that Isaiah 53 and verse 3 predicted that he would be despised and forsaken. And yet what does he do? He lovingly and patiently waits to pick up the pieces of our despair and to make us whole and free. He died on the cross even for those who rejected and crucified him, those who spat upon him. Now, think about this with me. He lovingly and patiently waits to save those who perhaps have cursed him, spat upon him, despised and rejected him. He waits for them to return so that he can make them whole, to make them free. Are good leaders in the cause of Christ above their teacher? Are they above their master? Turn back with me, if you would, to Matthew, the 10th chapter for just a moment. I say turn back because my Old and New Testaments are separate. I was in Luke 15, so I'm turning back in my New Testament. You may have to turn forward, obviously, from Exodus if that's where you are. But the point is, look in Matthew chapter 10 for just a moment at verses 24 and 25, where Jesus told his disciples, those closest to him, a disciple is not above his teacher, nor a slave above his master. It is enough for the disciple that he become as his teacher and the slave as his master. If they have called the head of the house Beelzebul, how much more the members of his household? Now, let me paint you a picture here for just a moment. You decide, because of these classes or not, you're going to try to help others come to Christ or come back to Christ. You're going to try to become a leader for the cause of Christ. You see people who are enslaved to sin, in the bondage of iniquity, destined for eternal torment. And you go to them and you offer them freedom, salvation through Jesus Christ. But the minute things begin to be difficult, the minute there is a physical hardship that is required because of their belief in and their commitment to God, they come back to you and they curse you. They rebel against your efforts. They reject you completely. Now, what's your response? Going to wash your hands of them and say, well, that's it. I tried. I'm done. You're going to shake the dust off your feet and move on to somebody else and just forget about them. They're not worth the effort. Is that what Moses and Aaron did here? Is that what Jesus did to those that rejected him and despised, shamed, and spat upon him? The job of deliverance from bondage and two, the blessings of the promised land wasn't finished. Moses and Aaron knew that. They've waited for these people to return to them, but when the people did return, they cursed them. So did Moses and Aaron just drop things and go back to Midian and say, "Enough, Lord, we tried. They wouldn't have it. I'm done. Nothing more I can do." Good leaders know that the job isn't easy. The job of spiritual leadership. And that it may indeed make them the object of scorn and ridicule, even cursing. Even from those that you're attempting to assist. But they don't cut and run. Not if they're good leaders. Again from the book of Luke, this time in the 6th chapter. Notice Luke 6, Jesus is again speaking here in verses 27 and 28. Think of this passage in a new light, perhaps, relative to our discussion here of leadership. "But I say to you," Jesus says, "I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you." Now, the text goes on, and there are other passages that say essentially the same thing in many places. Isn't that what Moses and Aaron did here? They didn't cut and run. Just because those they were attempting to lead have turned on them, cursed them, they still saw the goal as being worthwhile. We'll talk about that more in our next point. So let's move to our next point. Verse 22 says, no, I'm sorry, the latter part, the outline says verse 22. It's supposed to say verse 21. I'll try to get that corrected. The third point on your outline, the latter part of verse 22, says, I still said it wrong. The latter part of verse 21, these people saw only the immediate rather than the big picture. That's why they've said what they've said here. That's why they've done what they've done here. They're not able to see the big picture. Moses did. In Acts the 7th chapter in verse 25, we've looked at this passage before. Moses knew from the outset, before he ever left Egypt the first time, that God had appointed him as a leader. And he supposed that his brethren understood that God was granting them deliverance through him, but they didn't understand. I've got a news flash for you. They didn't understand it at the time that Stephen is referencing here before Moses has left Egypt. They still don't really understand it now. They did for a moment back in chapter 4 and verse 31 when they believed, when they bowed and worshiped God at the words of Moses that he was there to deliver them. But now that things have gotten hard, and they really haven't yet, only the edict has come down from Pharaoh that it's going to, and it will. But even now, just at the word, when they understand from verse 19 of Exodus 5 that they're in trouble, they go back to Moses and Aaron and they curse them. Why? Because they didn't see the big picture. They didn't realize that freedom isn't free, that physical hardships are often the price that is to be paid. Look in your text in Luke, the 14th chapter. We've referenced this a couple of times in past lessons, but let's go back to it for just a moment tonight. In Luke, the 14th chapter, in verse 25, great multitudes are following after Jesus. And he turns to these great thronging multitudes that are following after them, and he says this, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple." Whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. I've mentioned this before from verse 27. I'm going to mention it again. When Jesus is saying and talking about carrying the cross in verse 27, that doesn't yet have any spiritual significance to his audience. This is prior to his crucifixion on the cross. So there's no spiritual significance attached to those words in the hearing of his audience. They only hear, take up your cross and follow me, as a sign of your own destruction, the implement of your own torture and death. They're not attaching spiritual significance to picking up your cross and following after Christ in a spiritual way. They're only hearing these words and only thinking these things in physical terms. The text of Luke 14 goes on. Verses 28 through 35, Jesus continues to talk about counting the cost of discipleship. Well, what's the tie-in? Part of the big picture that Israel isn't yet seeing here in Exodus chapter 5 is exactly what Jesus was talking about. Doing the right thing may indeed have physical consequences that are hard, that are harsh. Jesus says it may cost you your family. It may cost you your life. You need to count the cost. And in order to do that, you need to see the big picture. Cost counting is liability versus rewards. Cost versus benefits. What is being presented to the Israelites in Exodus chapter 4 and Exodus chapter 5? Freedom from 400 plus years of bondage and servitude in Egypt. Not only freedom, but a land flowing with milk and honey, a renewed relationship with their God, in which He would bless them because they would be His people and He would be their God. What's it going to cost? Some hardship. Not only in the treatment from the Egyptians, but from the hardship of the journey from Egypt to Israel. And by the way, it wasn't supposed to last 40 years. That came as a result of them, again, not trusting God, not trusting God's appointed leaders, and rebelling against them. But even if the journey had taken the normal time to move 2.5 to 3 million people from Egypt to Canaan, you can look at the map behind me, see part of the journey there. That journey would have still been difficult, even if it had lasted the normal length of time. They weren't looking properly at the benefits, the rewards. They were only seeing the immediate, the short-term costs. They weren't seeing the big picture. Spiritual myopathy is a problem we still suffer from, even in the present day and age. The passage I've turned to is 2 Peter, the first chapter. I want to rearrange these verses for just a moment to drive this point home for us. In 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 9, he's talking about the Christian graces, as we sometimes call them, from verses 5 through 7. He says, "For he who lacks these qualities is blind." The Greek term there is tuphos. It means exactly that, not able to see. "Or short-sighted." Muupazo is the word there. It's from the Greek word is from that from which we get our word myopia or myopic. One who is short-sighted, only seeing those things that are up close. These are just some cheap cheaters I got probably at the discount store. I've got a set of prescription glasses. They're trifocals. Those other glasses, the top part, help me to see into the distance. The very bottom part helped me to see up close. After I get out to about 12 or 14 inches, I'm good. even out to 150 yards or so. So the middle part of those other glasses is just clear. But my point is, many of us are spiritually myopic. We only see those things that are up close. Now, Peter's going to describe that further for us here in this verse. For he who lacks these qualities, and again, those Christian graces from verses 5, 6, and 7, is blind or short-sighted, having forgotten his purification from his former sins. Israel is not remembering here in Exodus 5, they're slaves, and they have been for 400 years. And yes, there are some harsh treatments that are about to be enacted upon them, but God has promised them deliverance and their own country in which he's going to bless them. They're only seeing the short term. They're only seeing the cost, not the reward. They're only seeing the liability, not what they're going to receive. Now, in 2 Peter chapter 1 here, verse 8, I skipped over that one. The Christian graces are in verses 5 through 7. And he says in verse 8, if these qualities are yours and are increasing, they render you neither useless nor unfruitful in the true knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. If we're not adding these things to our faith, if we're not growing and maturing in all of these ways, then we are useless, we are unfruitful, and what's eventually going to happen is we will forget our former purification from sins, and we will become blind or at best short-sighted, not being able to look beyond the immediate hardship to the eternal reward. And because of those things, verse 4 says, we won't be able to escape the corruption that is in the world by lust. Now, I know I've rearranged those verses and adapted them to our purposes, but I think they fit fairly well, with the exception of maybe moving verse 4 around a little bit. It's talking about having become a Christian and having escaped the corruption that is in the world by lust. I'm applying it in a comparable way to escaping from the corruption of Egypt and that servitude there. But what I want us to understand, back here in Exodus 5, also from 2 Peter chapter 1, is that we're going to have to look at the big picture. If we don't grow as we should, we become useless and unfruitful. Our memory and our vision are going to fail us, and we'll be unable to continue to maintain that escape from the bondage of sin, and we'll go back to it. Just like the Israelites, from Acts chapter 7 and verse 39, from Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 39, wanted to return to captivity even after they became free because they were short-sighted, because they couldn't see the big picture. Because they couldn't see the promised land, only the immediate hardship of the journey, they wanted to go into captivity, return to captivity. Here, in Exodus chapter 5 and in verse 21, they're saying, Moses, you made it worse for us. We were better off before you came. We were better off when we were slaves to the Egyptians because they fed us and they gave us straw so we could make bricks for them. And I suppose they would have been content at this point remaining slaves in Egypt for another 430 years. This class is about leadership. Good leaders have good vision, and they remember what God has already done for them and for others, and what God has promised to do for those who will remain faithful to Him. Not only do they see the promised land from afar and long for that rest that Hebrews 4 talks about, they help others to see it. We'll look at verses 22 and 23 in our class next week, Lord willing. Moses and Aaron are here going to cry out to God, and that's okay, but they're not going to quit. They're going to go back and they're going to again encourage this people to remain faithful to the Lord, to move forward toward freedom and the promised land. Good leaders have good vision, they have good memories, and they help others to see the big picture that God has before us. They help others to look beyond the immediate consequences, perhaps even of doing the right thing. Sometimes that has negative immediate consequences, just the way Jesus talked about in Luke 14. Good leaders help us to see that what's going on to us is a reaction by Satan to us doing the right things. And it may get worse before it gets better, even as we talked about last week. But if we continue to remain faithful to God and press forward in right conduct, the grace of God will enable us to enter the promised land and receive all of the blessings that He has in store for us. I want us to look finally at 2 Corinthians, the 4th chapter, where Paul highlights some of these things for the Corinthians. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, allow me to read with you or read for you verses 16 through 18. There Paul writes, "Therefore we do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day." Verse 17, listen carefully in light of what we've just been talking about. "For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison." Good leaders help us to see those things. And if we're going to become good leaders, we have to help others see those things. That even our affliction is momentary and light and is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. Verse 18, "While we look not at the things which are seen," that's all Israel could see here in Exodus 5 and in verses 19, 20, and 21. That they were being beaten, that they were going to be required to continue in their servitude at an even more difficult level. Verse 18, "While we look not at the things which are seen, but the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal." If we're going to be good leaders, if we're going to respond in the right way to good leadership, we have to see the big picture. We have to help others see it as well. There is a tremendous need for spiritual leaders. There always has been, there always will be, as long as time remains. But what I want you to think about as we conclude this lesson for tonight is that we need leaders with patience. Those who are willing to wait while we fail and then have to come crawling back. We need patient leaders who are long-suffering. Because once they do come back, those who have failed may view us as being the problem and curse us and mistreat us. We need leaders that are patient and leaders that are long-suffering. But also we need leaders with vision. Vision enough to see back into our past and what God has done for His people throughout history. Our own personal past to see what God has done for us and what God has promised, looking forward to see what God has promised to do for those who will believe and trust in Him and obey Him. When we do those things, then we can see more clearly our present. That yes, there are some hardships involved, but those compared to that eternal weight of glory are but momentary and light afflictions. And that even if we should lose our lives, our very physical existence, the eternal reward will be far than more worth it. the exceeding weight of glory, that eternal weight of glory that is far beyond all comparison. We need leaders that not only see those things, but help others to see those things. If we're going to become good leaders, even when people, when they fail, when we have to let them fail, patiently wait for them to return, when they do, and even if they curse them, be long-suffering, and then help them to see the big picture rather than the little one. The big picture is spiritual. The little one is physical. We have to help others to see these things. All right, let's look at our questions for a few moments, and then I'll bid you good night for the evening. Number one, what is the significance, if any, of Moses and Aaron waiting for the foreman after they went in to plead their case before Pharaoh? Well, we talked about this in the outline. Number one, they knew the foreman's efforts weren't going to work since Pharaoh did not believe in God from verse 2 of chapter 5. And furthermore, he was the one who had issued the edicts concerning the harsh treatment in the first place. So number two, Moses and Aaron waited to pick up the pieces and try to move forward. Efforts to avoid the consequences of doing the right things usually fail. We have to go through and live with the consequences of turning to God and doing the right things, even if it costs us our family, even if it costs us some physical hardship. We looked at Luke 15 in these regards, as well as Luke 14, the prodigal son, and cost counting and of discipleship from Luke 14. Number two, what produced the dramatically different attitudes and action displayed in chapter 4 and verse 31 and chapter 5 and verse 21? 431, remember, as I emphasized at the beginning of class, the people, when Moses and Aaron lay out the scenario to them, believed, and when they recognized that God had listened and was aware of their plight, they bowed low and worshiped. Not only God, but paying homage also to Moses and Aaron as God's representative. Now, in chapter 5 and in verse 21, when hardships have been talked about and they have been beaten also, go back in the text and understand that the taskmasters did inflict hardship on them. They were beaten in verse 14. Why have you not completed your required amount yesterday or today in making brick? As previously, so when these hardships come about, the Israelites' attitude changed 180 degrees. They went from believing and worshiping God, accepting Moses and Aaron as his appointed leader, to coming back and now cursing Moses and Aaron, actually asking God to curse them, blaming them for the hardship. What changed? What produced the hardship did. That's Luke 14, verses 25 through 35, as we talked about it in the outline. As those led, we have to count the cost and be prepared to pay it, knowing that our investment, that eternal weight of glory that is far beyond all comparison for the Israelites, the land that flowed, that milk and honey which was before them, freedom from the bondage and servitude to the Egyptians, all of that was before them. But they were going to have to get past the hardships, the physical ramifications, if you will, of this new spiritual commitment to be God's people. As leaders, we need to practice full disclosure like Jesus did in Luke 14 and in Luke chapter 9, verses 57 through 62, where he told those that were presenting themselves to follow him, that it was going to cost them. We need to prepare them for those things. We need to remind them of those things when it happens. Go back and read 2 Peter chapter 1, verses 12 through 15, where Peter says a couple of times, I'm here to remind you of what you already know, what you've already been told. Peter's talking about persecution coming upon the people of God, and he's reminding them that it's going to happen and that they need to stay firm in their faith. Then we need to, as good leaders, help them with their perspective and progress through the physical hardships. So basically, the answer to number two is the physical hardships was the cause of that dramatically different attitude and incumbent action that was displayed in chapter 4, verse 31 through chapter 5. The other matters that we've discussed are what we should be learning from it. Number three, why should we not become discouraged in our efforts to help and lead others to lead others when we are met with rebellion, rejection, and even cursing? Jesus met with the same, and we're certainly no better than him. That's what we learned from Matthew 10, verses 24 and 25. And to be forewarned is to be forearmed. We're learning from this, from Moses and Aaron, that if we're going to lead people back to God, this kind of thing is going to happen. We need to be prepared for it. Expect it. That'll help you to be patient when it occurs, to be long-suffering when it happens, and then to be able to move forward and help them move forward afterwards. Remember what you're doing and why. The ultimate goal is to save a soul from eternal damnation. There is nothing that man can give in exchange for his soul. So we need to be patient, we need to be long-suffering, and then we need to get busy again, even after we've been cursed by those whom we're trying to help. Number four, what bigger picture did Moses see that Israel, at least in the context of this lesson, did not? He could see the promised land of rest and freedom and blessings for this people, which is comparable to heaven. I would urge you to go back and read Hebrews, the fourth chapter, Verses 6 through 16, where the Hebrew writer there makes a comparison between this people being given a Sabbath day's rest and how that Joshua was speaking of a different rest even beyond that Sabbath day, even beyond the physical land of promise, a spiritual land of rest, a spiritual land of promise. That's the big picture they weren't seeing. They couldn't see beyond the immediate hardship. Also, they failed to see the lesson of James chapter 1. James chapter 1, verses 2 down through about verse 13, is summarized. Let me just read the last of that. The first part of James 1 is talked about the necessity and the benefits of trials and tribulations, and that testing of our faith. And then James concludes in James chapter 1, that section at least, in verse 12, "Blessed is a man who perseveres under trial, for once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him." That's why I said earlier that these hardships could have been, at least in part, a testing of Israel from God. Are they really going to obey me? Are they really going to trust in me, even when times get hard? God didn't cause these persecutions, but certainly he's allowing them to happen. And he has his own purposes for Pharaoh and the Egyptians, but he may well have some purposes for the Israelites in helping to prepare them through these hardships to endure the hardships of the journey that is ahead of them to the promised land, that they may reach God's intended destination for them. Number five, what prevented Israel from seeing this bigger picture? And again, the answer to some degree is the immediate circumstance, specifically the hardship and the pain involved with breaking free. They also still had what I'm going to call the captive mindset. Look with me for just a moment to Hebrews, the 10th chapter, and verse 39. Now, the Hebrew writer, in an overall and vastly oversimplified way, is trying to encourage Hebrew Christians not to turn back to servitude and the bondage to the law of Moses in this Hebrew letter. But he's making some comparisons back to Israel's history, to their bondage to sin, to their difficulties and hardships they experienced not only in Egypt, but also on the journey to the promised land. And he says in Hebrews 10, verse 39, "But we are not of those who shrink back to destruction, but those who have faith to the preserving of the soul." He seems to be referencing the same thing in Hebrews 10, verse 39, that Stephen did back in Acts chapter 7 and verse 39. They repudiated God's leader. We're seeing that here in Exodus 5 and in verse 21 when they asked God to curse Moses and Aaron. And they are quite happy to go back into servitude if they could just go back to their former level of servitude. Because doing the right thing had some hard things attached to it. They've still got that servant bondage mentality. And therefore, they are at this point, at least in our text of Exodus 5, willing to shrink back to destruction. Look at number 6. The final question. This lesson highlights a few necessary characteristics for good leaders. What are they and why are they important? Well, number 1, patience. Moses and Aaron were patiently waiting for the leaders of Israel to return from their little effort to get Moses to get Pharaoh to recant. They knew it wasn't going to work, so Moses and Aaron are simply waiting. Patience is important for good leaders. I'll read to you from 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 24. "The Lord's bondservant must not be quarrelsome, but kind to all, able to teach, patient when wronged, with gentleness correcting those who are in opposition, if perhaps God may grant them repentance leading to the knowledge of the truth, that they may come to their senses and escape from the snare of the devil, having been held captive by him to do his will." That kind of patience that we're seeing manifested here is a characteristic that is going to be required of all good leaders. Secondly, I would talk about long-suffering. Moses and Aaron were just cursed by those they were trying to help. It happens. They were rejected, at least now. It's going to take some miracles from God to change things. But Moses and Aaron didn't cut and run. They stayed with the program. They were patient. They were long-suffering. They were diligent because they had vision. They had a clear remembrance of what God had done in the past for Moses and Isaac and Jacob. They had a clear vision of what God had promised to do in the future. Deliverance from captivity, sustenance on the journey, and blessings beyond comprehension in the promised land. They also had resolve. They kept on keeping on, understanding what was at stake. If good leaders today will remember what's at stake, that there's nothing that can be given in exchange for our own souls or for someone else's. It is the most precious possession and the only eternal one that any of us has. Be patient. Be men and women of vision. Be long-suffering and be resolved. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. It means a tremendous amount to me. May God bless all of your efforts to not only serve Him, but also to help others serve Him.